As we said last week, arguably the most important moment in the Rebbe's life may have been that moment in 1956 on the 8th anniversary of the State of Israel, where the Rebbe delivered this talk at Yeshiva University, sponsored by the Mizrahi, in honor of the 8th anniversary. That talk, which later became published under the title Kol Dodi Do Feik, became an epic-making statement of religious Zionism in the post-World War II era. No one has said it better, no one has said it more succinctly, no one has said it more forcibly. As we explained last week, the Rebbe speaks about the challenge to man. He has his quests for destiny, Yayud, and being only a human being at times, there is the goral, the fate, which may be different than his destiny. Nevertheless, the Jew has to constantly strive to achieve his destiny, and Be'ezrat Hashem B'Yamot HaMashiach, in the Messianic era, the destiny and fate, the Yayud and Goral, will blend into one. The Rav put this concept within the framework of Shir HaShirim. He spoke in terms of the Dod, the beloved, the male knocking on the door of the Dodah, and we have to be big enough to rise to the occasion, to answer the knock, to respond, to open the door, not like the Dodan Shir HaShirim, who Pashatati et Kuntati Echal Bishana, she already was ready to go to sleep, she couldn't wake up, didn't want to get dressed, put her makeup on, and she let her beloved walk away, and then she desperately searches for him, but will not find him, Ad Biat Mashiach Zidkenu. And the Rav said that God has knocked on our door. There were six miraculous knocks, six signs of unique happenings with the Jewish people that never happened before. And we have to be big enough to answer. We spoke about four of these defikot last week. And we spoke in terms of, first of all, the political miracle that for the first time in the United Nations history, Russia and the United States agreed, the Western Bloc and the Eastern Bloc both supported the formation of the State of Israel. The second great knock on our door was, of course, the miracle of a little army that won against so many, an army that was ill-equipped, an army that fought with davikids, as we know them, we see them in Yerushalayim, we see them in Svatavay, the davikot squares, and they won this tremendous victory against so many well-armed, well-trained Arab armies. The third knock on our doors, of course, was on the theological level, that the fact that there could be a State of Israel debunked Christian theology. We do not believe in Jesus, and yet we were privileged to come back home. The fourth knock, of course, the Rav spoke in terms of the assimilation of the youth, and finally, Jewish youth after the Holocaust, after World War II, Jewish youth was waking up, Jewish youth was returning home, Jewish youth now started to question who they were, where they came from, and the State of Israel put tremendous brakes on assimilation. And let me go further. There was a fifth knock on our door, a fifth miracle, and the Rebbe said perhaps this was the most important miracle of all. Having grown up in Europe, having seen Eastern Europe, having seen the Jew in Berlin, having seen what life was like for the Jew in the diaspora, the Rav could understand and appreciate and articulate this fifth knock, that for the first time in so many hundreds of years, well nigh thousands of years, the world was being taught a lesson, Dam Yehudi Eino Hefka, that Jewish blood is not ownerless, is not hefka. It's not something that you can take and destroy, and the Jew will not answer, the Jew will not fight back. The State of Israel accomplished what we couldn't do. We couldn't fight off Hitler. We couldn't fight off the pogroms. We'd suffered so much during World War I, during the interbellum period, during World War II. So much Jewish blood was shed. Jewish history reads like a martyrology, martyrdom, Akedat Yitzchak, time and again, decade and again, and generation after generation, and finally, miraculously, Dam Yehudi Eino Hefka. Yes, you can harm Jews, but you will pay a price. Your blood will be extracted in return. This is a lesson that the Jew could never exercise and practice for so long a period, for such a large epoch, for a millennium and a millennium, and now, Tam Yehudeinu Hefka. And the Rebbe said so beautifully, no one will accuse me, I'm paraphrasing the Rebbe as he spoke that night, no one will accuse me of not believing in Torah Shebaal Peh. And all of us know that when the Torah Shebichtav says, Ayin Tachet Ayin, an eye for an eye, the Torah Shebaal Peh states immediately, Mamon Tachet Ayin, that you have to redeem. You don't take out a person's eye because he knocked out someone else's eye. He has to expiate the crime by paying kofar mamon tachatayin. Nevertheless, the Rebbe said so beautifully, sometimes I feel that we must interpret the pasuk literally. And in contemporary times where we have so many enemies, where we have struggled so valiantly, I feel we have to take the pasuk literally, Ayin tachet ayin, and the world has to know that Jewish blood will not be hefka. We have to learn how to fight. We have to learn how to raise our hands and arms. We have to learn the lesson of Avraham Avinu by Erech Chanichav, how he rallied the troops when he went to save Lot and he went to save the kings. We have to learn from Moshe Rabbeinu by Yachet HaMitzri, how Moshe Rabbeinu had the courage, the nerve to destroy the Egyptian who was decimating the Jews. We have to follow their examples. And please don't let anyone rebuke us and give us musa and tell us we're not ethical. Throughout the generations, how much blood we have lost, how much Jewish blood has been shed because we were not able to enact the ayin tachet ayin literally, because we turned the other cheek and everyone knew that Jewish blood is cheap. And the Rebbe said very dramatically, Baruch Shechiyonu, Lazman Hazeh, Sheyehudim Yesh Bekolcham, Be'ezrat Hashem, Lahagein Alatzman. Shechiyonu Bekimanu, that we reached a stage in life where the Jews have the strength, with the help of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to defend themselves. So, this was the fifth great miracle. And of course, when we look back today, we take it for granted that you can defend yourself. This is axiomatic. We think in terms of Meir Kahane's aphorism, never again. But the Rav at that moment in time, having grown up in Europe, having experienced anti-Semitism, having been beaten up more than once, and even in Berlin, the Rav described how on New Year's Eve, some fat German with a beer belly, as the Rav so beautifully pictured him, beat him up, and what could a Jew do? This was part of being a Jew, and then the Hitler period. And here we are, a little state of Israel. But Dam Yehudi Eino Hefka. And then the Rebbe spoke in terms of the sixth miracle, the sixth knock on our door. And of course, at that moment in time, it could be fully appreciated. The borders of Israel were open, the doors of Israel were open. Every Jew could come an aliyah. And you have to remember, we had a white paper, the English government, and so many hundreds of thousands of Jews, perhaps millions, could have been saved had the doors of Israel been open, but the doors were shut. And now we have a miracle. Every Jew has a homeland to welcome him. And the Rebbe described the Sephardic Aliyah, and he says, what would have happened? Who could imagine what would have been if the state of Israel was not open to accept the refugees from the Sephardic, from the Arabic countries? And thank God we had the state, and when they were driven out of their countries, they had where to go. And the Rebbe describes the state of Israel in beautiful poetic terms. V'hi koletet et baneha ke'em rachmaniya. And she takes in her children like of a loving mother who's welcoming back her long lost children who are finally coming home. Ke'em rachmaniya. And he says, yes, the state didn't come quickly enough for the Hitleristic Holocaust, Halavai, we would have had a state, hundreds of thousands of Jews would have been saved from the gas chambers, from Hitler's concentration camps. The miracle of the state was late in coming, but thank God it is here now. It is here at last. The period of God's hiding his face, of chesed upon him, is over. Nitnahev sharut liyehudim hanitlashim mimekomotem lishtaresh be'eretz hakodesh. Jews now, when chased out of their own country, when feeling uncomfortable, now have the Holy Land. They can come in Aliyah. They will be received. They will be welcomed. Al yehei hadavah hazeh kal be'einenu. Let's not treat this lightly. What a great achievement after World War II, after the white paper, after the displacement camps. After Jews were singing, we have no place to go, give us a home. And God did the miracle. And this is the sixth knock. Kol do di do fake. Look at these six magnificent knocks. Will the Jews be big enough to answer? Will the Jews rise to the occasion? Will the Jews accept the divine challenge? Will the Jews be more bright, more intelligent, more active than the Dodar and Shir HaShirim? Will they open the door and accept the quest that God has put in front of them? Will they change their Yehudim life and go forward and meet the challenge of the state of Israel reborn? Every child growing up in the state of Israel exposed to religious Zionist education on a high school level, on a collegiate level, on advanced yeshiva level, on an upana level, was raised and nurtured on this talk, which turned into the essay, Kol Dodi Do Fake. Yes, at this moment, the Rav affected hundreds of thousands of lives, ultimately, millions of lives, and this essay continues to impart succor, encouragement, understanding, and hope, enthusiasm, as the reborn state of Israel continues in its journey before God and man. However, there is one very basic question that has to be asked here. The question has been asked many times. Perhaps it's a question that's not in place, as I will explain in a moment. I was asked this question practically from the first day I came in Aliyah more than 33 years ago. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein was asked this question many times. Above all, a magnificent letter, a magnificent exchange of correspondence was made public just a few years ago. The Rav was asked this very question, and he also responded to it. And of course, the question that we all have to face is, how could the man who said these magnificent words, delivered this magnificent drasha, published this essay, allowed it to circulate in so many different publications afterwards, how could it be that the Rav himself did not come an Aliyah? And this is the question. And let me handle it on a number of different levels and then come to the Rav's answer. Rav didn't come an Aliyah. Fact. The question is a bit unfair because when you look at the Rav's life, 1935, he wanted to come in Aliyah. His yayud was to come in Aliyah. The Goral willed otherwise. Rabbi Lichtenstein makes the point in that essay I'm quoting from the recent Alon Shvut that in 1935, primitive country, lagged in development behind even Eastern Europe. All of you know that when people went in Aliyah from Poland and other countries in Eastern Europe, many of those they left behind were apprehensive, not just religiously. that they will assimilate into secular Zionism. But they were apprehensive on a physical, material level. You're going to a land that is humps, a land that has malaria, a country that is very primitive. And you're leaving a civilized Eastern European country to go in Aliyah? And here was the Rav in the United States of America, in Boston. And remember, by 1935, the Depression was starting to ease. And the Rav actively sought out the chief rabbinate, stood as a candidate for the chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv. So you see, it's an unfair question. He wanted to go in Aliyah. And I must tell you that I had a lot of joy when I read Rav Aaron Lichtenstein alluding to this, because one of my earliest experiences in the State of Israel, perhaps going back to 1970 or 1971, when people were starting to question the Israelis, the religious Zionist movement here, what you call the Mizrahi, the B'nai Akiva element, the Kibbutz Adati element, they started to question, who is this Rav Soloveitchik? By the 60s already, people heard his name. People started to read. By that point already, they had the Kol Dudit of Faith. They had the Ish Emunah in Hebrew, the Lonely Man of Faith. And students of the Rav started coming Aliyah. And Arik Kepet was invited to Kibbutz Stei Eliyahu. And after I finished this lecture, and this goes back 32 years, I would imagine, I finished this lecture on the Rav, and a hand shoots up, and Kibbutz members, intelligent people, why didn't the Rav come on Aliyah? And instantaneously I answered, why didn't he come on Aliyah? Because you didn't want him. And everyone looked at me and they, well, what do you mean? I said, the Rav wanted to come on Aliyah. 1935, you didn't elect him. He knocked on the door. He wanted to stand for the chief rabbinate of Tel Aviv. You didn't elect him. What kind of question is this? The question should be, why didn't you have the foresight to elect the Rav in 35? And I have to tell you, after the lecture, the late, he just passed away, Rabbi Dr. Eliezer Goldman was an early graduate of Yeshiva, and Yeshiva Mitzchol Chan was a Talmud of Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, came in Aliyah in the 40s already, was a Chaver Kibbutz Eliyahu. He came over to me and said, you gave a beautiful answer. You understand, sometimes in life, that's a very unfair question. It's like asking someone, why you married this girl and not the other girl? That's the way life works out. And when you were looking, when you were going out, when you were dating, this girl was the girl you met, the other girl you didn't meet, you understand? Well, whatever the reasons are, life does not always fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. There's goral and there's yeyud, to use the Rav's own words. Now, if you take the chief rabbinate and you go a little bit further, look what happens. 1959, Chief Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Halevi passes on. The Rav by that time has become the Rav. Remember, 1930s in Boston, basically unknown, unfulfilled. He's in Boston, a gaon adir, a scion of the great Brisk Belashen dynasty. A man who the Kovner Rav, Rav Avraham Dovid Kahana Shapiro, said about him in his famous letter that the Rav has the ability of his grandfather, Reb Chaim, and that the halacha kamoto b'chomakom, that he is the man who will decide halacha for the future generations. And this is the Kovner Rav, the Devar Avraham. And here the Rav is in Boston, with all the respects to Boston. He is a man with a PhD in philosophy, University of Berlin. And he's caught up in the minor politics of a very weak, fledgling orthodoxy in Boston. So he comes to Israel and he desperately tries to become the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, and he's not elected. Of course, you can always wonder, and if it's the longest, largest, most important word in the dictionary, imagine how the Rav would have developed in Israel. Imagine what would have become with this man, with his mind, with the interaction, with the reborn, with the nascent state, with the halachic problems, with the relationship between the Chiloniyim and the Datiyim, with the mantle and heritage of Avraham Yitzchak, a Kohen Cook. You can think about it. It is mind-boggling. But it didn't work out that way. 1959, Rav Herzog dies. The most famous Lithuanian rabbi in the State of Israel at that time was Rav Reuben Katz, the author of the Degel Reuven, the chief rabbi of Petach Tikva. Those of you, and you're all here from Yeshiva University, Gris Kollel, you all know that there's a Rebbe still teaching YU. He's the last surviving child of Rabbi Reuben Katz's 8 children, Reb Michal Katz. He was my own Rebbe when I entered the Yeshiva in 1951 through 1953. He should live and be well. This was Reb Michal Katz's father. Reb Michal Katz was the intermediary. He ran the messages between his father and between the Rav. And Reb Reuven Katz went to work. He had a lot of prestige. He was the Petach Tikva Rav. He was a Gaon Adir. He was the author of the Degel Reuven. He was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Lamshi Yeshiva in Petach Tikva. He was a member of the Chief Rabbinate's Council. He was revered and looked up to by all elements. He was a great Mizrachiyit and a great Torah personality. And he worked for the Rav to be elected unanimously as the Ashkenazic Chief Rabbi of the State of Israel. And they negotiated with the Rav. They told him, and think for a moment what I'm saying. In 1935, the Rav made the trip, a long, difficult journey on the boat to stand for the Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv, and he was not elected. And in 1960, Rav Reuben Katz was organizing and ready to declare, Rav Soloveitchik, you will be the Chief Rabbi of the State of Israel, elected unanimously. And the Rav turned down the offer. And why? And why? And to me, I saw the Rav's letter. The Rav wrote a letter to Rav Reuben Katz, which he showed to some of his close students. And the letter was a beautiful letter. It's been quoted and widely quoted, where the Rav speaks about the politicization of the Israeli rabbinate, the difficulty in being a rabbi, where you have to deal with politics, where for the sake of argument, the cabinet discusses halachic problems and expresses an opinion. The cabinet of the State of Israel, they're not Tamidei Chachamim, they're not Goyim, they're not Poskim, they're not, many of them are not Yirei Shemayim, and they're expressing an opinion in Halacha, and the Rav feels he could not handle it. And the Rav describes, Rav Reuben Katz, that you were great enough to be both a Rebbe and a Rosh Yeshiva and a Posek, and to be part of the Israeli Rabbinate, but the Rav feels that he would not be able to handle it, and therefore he requests that Rav Reuven Katz withdraw his nomination. And the truth is, the position remained unoccupied for a number of years until in the mid-60s they finally elected Rav Isa Yehuda Unterman. He was of England, and he was a Litvisher Bamakar in his origins, and he, of course, became the next chief rabbi of the State of Israel. I think it's much deeper than that. And I think the Rav alludes to it too in the letter to Rav Reuben Katz, and that letter has never been published in totality. I don't know whether it has survived the passage of time. Those of us that saw the letter remember it. The Rav quoted it, particularly the part I just quoted to you now. But I think the answer is much more basic. It's the Goral and the Yehud. There was one tremendous difference between 1935 and 1960. 1935, the Rav was a young man searching, looking, trying to find his role, his place in life. By 1960, he had his niche. He was 25 years older. He was already entering beyond middle age, even old age. His health already was not the best, but he had his niche. He had become the Rav. He had become the Rebbe Muvhak of modern orthodoxy, or what is called popularly modern orthodoxy. He had his little classroom in Yeshiva University on the first floor opposite the Beis Medrash, room 102, I believe it was. And in that little classroom, there were two doors. It was a larger room than usual, I believe, ultimately. Or what really happened was that they combined two classrooms to make one classroom for the Rav. And out of that little classroom, he had the most devoted students. He had the best minds on the Torah scene. From that little classroom, his influence went all over Yeshiva University, all over the Rabbinical Council of America, all over the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations, all over the Young Israel movement in the United States. By 1960, he was a fixture. He had found his niche. He had found his fulfillment. He had uncovered and discovered and succeeded in what certainly was one of his most important shlichiyot messengers in life. And the Rav was now the Rav, the Rabban Shel Bnei Yisrael. So, of course, you can't compare who he was in 1935 and what he became in 1960 or by 1960. And therefore, you have to understand, the question now becomes a vulgar question. Why didn't the Rav come in Aliyah? Well, when the Rav was willing, when he was knocking on the door, the Doda, the state of Israel in its nascent form, the Moatzah HaDatit, the religious council of Tel Aviv, didn't open the door. And when the door was open and the Doda said, enter, come in, the Dode already was preoccupied for many reasons. His niche in life, his place in life, his success, older, ill health, a little bit more aged, the journey, the difficulty, the reestablishment, children, grandchildren out on American soil at that time. You have to view it in context. So that certainly is absolutely part of the story, and maybe the major part, maybe the most important point, why the Rav did not come an Aliyah. But of course, the question becomes a little bit more difficult. Why didn't he visit? Everyone knows that the Rav was in Israel once, 1935. He never visited Israel again. And of course, this question too has to be seen in context. 1935, he returned to America. He gets involved in the rabbinate. He gets involved in trying to straighten out kashrut. He gets involved in the long, drawn-out kashrut investigation in Boston. World War II breaks out. His father dies. He comes to New York. He's thinking of leaving Boston. There's a lot of thought in the mid-40s of going to Chicago. By the time he opens his eyes, it's the 1950s. Travel to Israel is difficult. It's not like today that you get on a plane, you daven Maariv in New York, you daven Shachris at the Kotel, you daven Maariv at the Kotel, you daven Shachris in New York. It's a difficult, travel was more difficult. And there may have been another factor as well. And I think this is, I don't think it's a major factor, but I think it is a contributing factor as to why the Rav was not anxious to visit Israel during this period, particularly the 1950s. And the answer is family relations. And here, of course, we come to the Briska family. What's fascinating is, and hard to explain, when you speak in terms of the Soloveitchik dynasty, the Soloveitchik family, you all know that the family split. Reb Chaim had two famous sons. Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, that was his second son, and his younger son was Reb Yitzchak Zev or Reb Velvula Soloveitchik. Reb Moshe comes to the United States. Reb Moshe emigrates in 1930. Reb Velvel is saved from Hitler, although part of his family is wiped out, his wife and some of his children, lo aleinu, and Reb Velvel comes on Aliyah to Yerushalayim. So here you have one son of Reb Chaim going to the United States, and one son of Reb Chaim going on Aliyah to Yerushalayim, Mir HaKodesh. Who is the Mizrachiite? What family becomes very active? The Soloveitchiks will go to America. Reb Moshe himself is a Mizrachiite. And all his children, without exception, are Mizrachiites. Two of them become prime theologians of the Mizrachi movement. The Rav and his kid brother, the Rav was the eldest of five children, right? The Rav, and then there's Shmuel Yaakov Soloveitchik, my professor, doctor, professor of chemistry. I see his face before my eyes as I speak to you. Then, of course, the Rav's sister, Shulamit Meiselman, Ann Gerber, and then the baby, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Zeichet Tzadik Levracha. No, the Rav and Rav Aaron, dominant spokesmen, ideologians for the Mizrahi movement. And the Soloveitchik family that comes in Aliyah, not only anti-Mizrahi, anti-Agudat Yisrael, very close to the Eidah HaRedit in the full sense of the word. Reb Velvel, great rabbis, rabbinical leaders from the United States came to visit Reb Velvel. And they asked him, why are you so opposed to the Mizrahi movement? These were heads of rabbinical council, Talmidim of the Rav. And Rav Velvel told his son, give me the shoebox. He pulled out a shoebox, and in the shoebox, endless clippings of Mizrahi, Kibbutz Hadati, calls for revising Halacha. Kibbutz Hadati was always, to a certain degree, in, it represented what Eida is today, if I can make a popular analogy. They were on the cutting edge. And Rav Velvel took out, they want to abolish Kalisha, they want to do this, they want to cut out the long Tachnun on Monday and Thursday. Various innovations that were being proposed in certain kibbutzim. Some were more traditional kibbutzim, more conservative with a small c. Others were more innovative, and Rav Velvel showed the visiting American rabbis. I heard the story when the rabbis returned, but it's written up in the four volumes on the Rav Velvel, on the Brisker Rav, that came out about 2 years ago. You'll find by Mela, he's actually a son-in-law of someone who taught in BMT, you'll find the story recorded there exactly as I heard it many decades ago. So it's fascinating. The Rav's part of the Soloveitchik family winds up in America, and almost without exception, they're Mizrahiites. And Rav Velvel, the other part of Reb Chaim's family, the other part of the Soloveitchik family, winds up in the Palestine, which then becomes the state of Israel, and they are totally anti-Mizrahi 100% until today. Now, how does this come to a head? The early 50s, the Mizrahi movement gets a very large donation from Sir Isaac Wolfson of London. That's the Spencer and Marks stores. Those of you who know anything about England, that's like talking about Macy's in the United States. And Sir Isaac Wolfson builds Heichal Shlomo. Now, when Heichal Shlomo was built, the room where the Dayanim used to sit, you have to remember, Heichal Shlomo today is basically an empty building. But it originally was built as the seat of the chief rabbinate with offices of the two chief rabbis. There's a window with a balcony where it's shaped in a where the rabbis can come out and bless the people underneath. If you look up at the building, you'll see that odd-shaped balcony where the chief rabbi would stand or the chief rabbis would stand. And it was built to bless the throng standing downstairs because this is when we did not have the kotel. This was built during the period between the Milchemet HaShichrua to the Six-Day War, when we did not have the Kotel, and Heichal Shlomo was the foremost place of religious experience and crowds coming together on the Olel LeRegel, etc. And that's where the chief rabbis, whatever goes on at the Kotel today, went on King George Avenue underneath that balcony. Go inside the building, and there's to be shown the hall where the chief rabbinical court, the supreme rabbinical court, sat, Beit Din Gadol Urim, and you'll see it's in a semicircle. Why is it in a semicircle? The Gemara and Sanhedrin, that the members of Sanhedrin should see each other while they're making a decision, while they're thinking and learning, while they're having a debate on what the halacha should be, because eye contact is extremely important. That's why it's a semicircle. So the Briska family issued a cheirim against building Heichal Shlomo, against entering Heichal Shlomo. They were apprehensive that the Mizrahi was going to restore the Sanhedrin. The whole debate whether we can jumpstart, if I can use a modern term, but that's exactly what we're talking about. If we can jumpstart the real Sanhedrin again before Mashiach comes, can we jumpstart the Sanhedrin with ordination, ish mi piyish, the ordination that goes back to Moshe Rabbeinu? This is the whole question based upon the Gisser and the Rambam. In Hilchat Sanhedrin, what does the Rambam mean? Rov Chachmei Yisrael, the majority of the Jewish sages living in Israel, come together. Can we anoint someone? Can they restart this concept of smicha that would give us the ability to be posek, dinei nefashot, and dinei knasot, and dinei malkot, and inaugurate gezerot and takonet that would be binding on everyone, and Torah Shebaal Peh, and midat shatorah nidreshet behem, with all the implications. And you all know what went on 400 years ago when this machloket became halacha lemaisa between the Beirav and the Ralbach and Eretz Yisrael and the Machaber and the Radbaz and what went on here with ordination. Can we start it? Can we restart it in Tzvat? And the Briska family was apprehensive that this was the purpose behind Heichal Shlomo. We are building a room, a place for the Sanhedrin. We are going to reestablish the Sanhedrin. Rav Maimon, who was the first Sahad that taught the first minister of religion in the state of Israel, a great Mizrahi leader, Rav Yehuda Leib HaKon, Fishman Maimon. Maimon was his Hebraized name, and he was a good friend of Ben Gurion, and he wrote a book on the Kaddish Sanhedrin. And the issue where every Rav was asked your opinion, to comment, the Rambam, La Halacha, La Maisa, it's a new state of Israel. Remember, those were great moments, heady moments. Those were moments of apocryphal vision happened before our eyes, all these knocks on the door, all these miracles, and there was so much talk and discussion. And the Briska Rub's family, the Briska Rub, Reb Velvel, the last surviving son of Reb Chaim, the Briska Rub, Chvoldo V'Atzmo, was apprehensive 100% that the Mizrahi was out to revise, to innovate, to change Torah and to use the overall gushpanka, to give it the overall permissibility through the instrument of the revival of the Sanhedrin and the original smicha. And you're not allowed to go into Heichal Shlomo. Tremendous opposition, spearheaded by the Briska Rav. Now, Lu Yitzuya, could you imagine the Rav visits Israel? The great Mizrahi leader, the man who uttered the words that formed the essay, Kol Dodi Do Fake, and he would not give a public lecture in Heichal Shlomo? It could not be. On the other hand, view the other side of the coin. With all the difference in ideology about the Soloveitchik family, it has to be said, blood is a lot thicker than water, or blood is a lot thicker than mud. The Rav retained a very strong, warm, ongoing relationship with his uncle. The Rav referred to him, mein Vetter, my uncle, Reb Velvel. The Rav raised funds. All American rabbis of that era, myself included, can testify that when the Rav spoke at the annual SCA convention, many times he would finish and say, you all know, he would talk Yiddish, you would all know, he said, that I bet nicht kein Geld für mein Schirm, I never asked you to pay me for my lectures, but I would like you to support my uncle's kollel in Yerushalayim. And many of the Rabbanim, myself included, wrote out checks to the Briska Rav, to the Briska Kollel in Yerushalayim, even in the 60s. By that time, the Briska Rav was no longer alive, but it was his children, and some of them until today run the Briska institutions, his children of Vevelvel that are still alive, and of course, grandchildren of Vevelvel that today are the Rosh Yeshiva in a number of different Briska institutions. So you see, the Rav retained a warm relationship. It was an interesting phenomenon that here you have the Rav, the PhD from Berlin, the Bostoner Rav, the YU Rosh Yeshiva, and here you have Reb Velvel and his sons so distant from the world in which the Rav now lives and functions, but as distant as they were, the basic gestalt, the basic soul remained the same. It was brisk, it was lulzhen, it was Torah after the Holocaust. And the Rav retained this close relationship with his family. So to me, it appears, and I heard this from others who were close to the Rav, that this certainly was a factor. On one hand, how could the great Mizrahi leader, the great Mizrahi visionary, how could he come and not give shir in Heichal Shlomo? And concomitantly, the Rav, as the nephew of Reb Velvel, the Rav who yet spoke in learning with Reb Velvel in Warsaw, with Reb Velvel in Poland, with Reb Velvel when he was growing up, the Rav who corresponded with Reb Velvel, as you see from the Igrot HaGrid that was recently published by the Rav's son, by my classmate, by Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, you see that here the Rav had an ongoing relationship with Reb Velvel. And here he has this great dilemma, and he simply avoids it by staying in Boston, by staying in New York, and not making that long, difficult, arduous journey across the ocean to the state of Israel. Of course, later on, old age, ill health, and mourning are contributory factors. So the question perhaps is not a legitimate question. Perhaps the question shouldn't be asked. Perhaps the question represents human frailty, and we have to understand there's destiny, there's fate. 35, think for a moment what would have been. Think where the state of Israel would have been. Of course, what would have become with Yeshiva University? But 35, think of the Rav's Torah, think of the Rav's own development. He was young, he was a going idea, his mind was so seminal and fruitful and innovative. Think of the difference of the challenge of Boston and New York vis-a-vis the challenge of Tel Aviv and Yerushalayim, the late 30s into the 40s, into the 50s. It defies imagination, but it was not willed to be. The people in Israel weren't smart enough, or perhaps the divine providence felt that we needed him in America so that one day we'd be sitting here in Yerushalayim teaching his Torah, analyzing his life, standing in revere of our great Rebbe that we were privileged to sit at his feet. Okay, take it as you wish. But by 1960, it's 25 years later, it's now the Rav, it's not just Rabbi Soloveitchik of Boston, his niche, his classroom, his desk, his students, the factors of life, we grow older, the health factor, and the relationship with the Brisker Rav, Heichal Shlomo, the difficulties, why put yourself into such a difficult situation? Shevi al tasa adif, if I may use the rabbinic aphorism, shevi al tasa, stay behind, sit, don't move. That is more important. That solves the problem, doesn't create a dilemma, doesn't put you in a quagmire, doesn't put you in a situation where you cannot win. No matter what you choose, you're going to have people angry at you. The Mizrahi will be upset, or the great Brisker family will be upset with you. Why put yourself into such a quagmire? Shevi al taseh adif. However, one of the most beautiful and fascinating documents that will survive the passage of time emerges as a result of all that I have described to you. And I want to dedicate the next part of the lecture to the memory of Rebbetzin HaMachanechet Miriam Shiloh, Zichrona Tzadeket Levracha. Her husband, Harav Daniel Shiloh, is the Rav of Kedumim in the Shomran. And Miriam was a machanechet. I don't know her entire life, but I can put it together from her correspondence with Rebbe. She evidently was a young lady raised with the ideology of Bnei Akiva. And she was a machanechet in a Mizrahi complex, a high school which has a teacher's college in Givat, Washington. Some of you have probably heard of it. And of course, she was teaching her students the Kol, Dodi, Dofek. And then came the Six-Day War. And we don't have a copy of the letter she wrote to the Rav, but it's obvious from his answer what the letter was. And in this letter to the Rav right after the Six-Day War, and you have to understand the Six-Day War had the greatest impact on the Jewish people. It was as if the Six-Day War put God back into history. The chestaponim of the Holocaust had finally ended. Here the Jews, for weeks before Nasser and the Arab armies and the UN and the East European countries, the communist countries, had convinced everyone that Israel will be wiped off the map. They were laughing, they were smiling. There were meetings at the UN, and you could see Nasser and the Arab representatives and the Russian and Polish representatives. Finally, they were going to finish the work that Hitler began. And then came 6 days, epic making. The Rav said, I may quote, that these 6 days were like biblical history. And the Rav said, what characterizes biblical history? Biblical history, events move very quickly. You read a parsha, and in one parsha, so much happens. You take a look, the brothers come down to Egypt, they go back, they go forth, they return, a brother is left, they go to their father. In one parsha, years, months are detailed in limited sentences. Epic-making events happen, and all you have are a few sentences. That is biblical history. The 6 days of war, every day was like biblical history. It happened so quickly. Yehuda, the Shomron, the Golan Heights, Gaza, Suez Canal, and above all, East Jerusalem, HaKotel HaMaravi, Har HaBayit, Makom HaMikdash, Har HaBayit B'Yadenu is in our hands. Days. And on the seventh day, God rested, and the Jews, it was overwhelming. They hit Orarut, the revival, the knocking on the door, the Aliyah, America, Russia, the whole start of the Serivnikim, the Refusnikim. Oh, what the 6 days did, the Baal Tshuva movement, BMT, exporting Torah to the Anglo-Saxon world from the holy city of Jerusalem. What these 6 days accomplished. And of course, the people were confused, the confusion that lasts and proved today. We're in the year 2002, practically 2003, and still, what do we do? The land and the Arabs and the Palestinians and Yehuda, the Shomron, and the old city of Jerusalem, and the Arabs within our midst, and these overwhelming questions, and Geula and redemption, Abchalt of the Geula, start of the Geula, the questions were started to be asked. And this young lady at the time, Miriam Shiloh, wrote a letter to the Rav. And in the letter, she writes to the Rav, how can it be, my students ask me, that the great man who uttered these fabulous words of kol do di do fake did not come in Aliyah? And she writes to the Rav with great derech eretz and reticence, forgive me, but we need you more than ever now. It is a time of confusion. We need guidance. We need religious leadership. Please, why can't you come and Aliyah? Such a beautiful letter, such beautiful sentiments. I'm a chanechet, I imagine, of a class of high school students. And high school students are very sincere. They're still young. They're not sophisticated. When we grow older, we grow more polished and more sophisticated. This is why you can't trust an older person. But generally speaking, a younger person can be trusted. He's honest. He's sincere. He's dedicated. How many of us shaped our lives during our high school years? Because those are the most formative years. Those are the most honest years. We're old enough to understand something already, and we're young enough yet to be totally honest. And these students turned to the Rav. Now, I would imagine that Rebbe received many letters. I'm positive he didn't answer all the letters he received. It probably became impossible. Rebbe spoke at one time that he wishes he could rip the phone out of the wall. That's a talk he gave to the YURA in 1956. He speaks about the Narishkeit they call him with. So I don't know if Rebbe answered all his letters, particularly strangers. All right, if I wrote him a letter, I got an answer. If Rabbi Reuben wrote him a letter, he got an answer. But I don't know total strangers writing letters. And this came at a very difficult moment in the Rav's life. This letter came to the Rav at a time that he experienced Churban HaBayit. All of you know the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Chaf Bet, that when a man's kishametolav isha rishona, when a man's first wife dies, this is the eshet nurim. This is what the prophet speaks about. Eshet nurim ki tima es. Can one despise the wife of his youth? And the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, lachol yesh tmura, chutz me eshet nurim shenema. And everyone, the Gemara says, unbelievable. Everything in life can be replaced. The one concept in life that can't be replaced by definition is the wife of one's innocence, the wife of one's youth. And the Gemara continues, when the wife of one's youth dies, it's as if the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed in his lifetime. So all of you know that in Taina Desta, 1967, before the Six-Day War, the Rebbe's wife, Rebbetzin Tanya Levitt Soloveitchik, passed on. And the Rebbe received this letter, and Miriam Shiloh was privileged to receive a handwritten, magnificent, two-page answer from the Rebbe. The letter was not made public until her death, and I was privileged that a copy was sent to me, and I was able to transcribe it in a much more readable form than the Rebbe's Hebrew handwriting. He was a left-handed to begin with. He was a genius on top of it, so that the Rebbe's handwriting was not the easiest to decipher. And I want to share this letter with you. It's a document that goes way beyond the moment. And the Rebbe writes, Kvod HaGeveret Miriam Shiloh Shetichya, Shalom Avracha. He asked her forgiveness that he didn't answer her right away, why he waited until now. The letter, by the way, is dated Yom Gimel Tzom HaRevi'i, which would mean Yud Zayin Tammuz Tashkaz. It means the letter was written July 25th, 1967. So I would imagine she wrote the letter the week after the Six-Day War, where the students returned to class and came out of the shelters, and they probably were studying the Kol Dovido fake that year, and the girl said to the Morat, to the Machanechet, Morati, how can it be that Rav Soloveitchik didn't come an Aliyah? And she sent the letter out, and a month later, the Rav answered July 25th, 1967. And the Rav says, it's very difficult for me to write because I am totally in avela, totally in mourning for the death of my wife. And the Rebbe describes his wife. Maybe he knew he was writing to women and he wanted them to understand how much he loved his wife and respected his wife. This itself is a document, the Rebbe's relationship with his wife. Bavatainai, chendat napshi, rayati hachabiba, zichron alavracha. And look at the Rebbe's description, the light of his eyes, the joy of his soul, his beloved wife. And he said, my world has collapsed. My world is destroyed. My wife has died. And remind you, this was written in July. She died. This was written on Yud Zayin Tammuz. His wife died, of course, on Tainit Esther months before. And he says, even now, a few months later, I write with blood, the blood of my broken heart at the death of my wife. And I write with tears, and I write with blood. Bidema, it's a play on words, because Moshe Rabbeinu, according to one opinion, wrote the last 8 words of the Torah, bidema, with tears, ubedam libi hakarua. And I'm writing with the blood of my heart, my broken heart. And he says, you have to forgive me. You have to understand. And he says, I thank you very much for your words. I accept the rebuke willingly. I have sinned against the Holy Land. Amnan chatati le'eretz hakodesh. The Rav writes, to imagine to a woman he never met, to children he never knew, the Gadol Hadar, look at the humility. He writes, yes, I have sinned against the Holy Land. Hinni bein ha-mafagrim. I'm those that have been, how would we translate mafagrim into proper English? We use mafager in Hebrew. It's used for someone that's not properly developed, but that would be too harsh a translation. Among the slow ones, I think, would be a better translation. And here the Rebbe says exactly what I told you. See, it's an unfair question. Muvan shahabeyga mimbil titlin biikveini. A lot of matters that were beyond my control held me back. But I don't look for excuses. I don't want to justify my actions. I have sinned. And hakalat tolui betzavari. and the yoke of sin rests on my neck. And then he tells something that I happen to know, and here I can validate. He says, you should know that my wife and I have often spoken about coming to Israel. And had my wife lived, I can tell you we had reached the conclusion we would spend 6 months a year in the Holy Land. To see the land, to see the people who live in it. Ulam rabot machshavot b'leiv adam. Iram ashira v'rabot anchati b'libi davoy. And look at that magnificent Hebrew that only the Rav had. And he says, what can I tell you? There are many thoughts in man's heart. Habei machshavot b'leiv adam. Vatzat Hashem hitakum. You all are familiar with it. We say in Yiddish, Mensch tracht und Gott lacht. A man thinks and God laughs. And look what happened. And now I'm filled with sorrow. My heart is heavy with despair. And all these plans to live 6 months a year in Israel have come to naught. And he says, yes, it's true. Many of those who know me, see, the Rebbe revealed it, total strangers, revealed his whole inner soul. He says, many of those who know me, many of those who are my friends, both in Eretz Yisrael and both in diaspora, are pleading with me to come now after the Six-Day War. And you too, my dear lady, specified in her letter, Kishat Ratzon, it's a V'gam Shat Mashper Ruchani, Hiata, that it's a Shat Ratzon, an Eik Ratzon, the Six-Day War, the victories, the return of God, the history is the way people spoke about it. But it's also Mashber Ruchani. What are we? Who are we? What has happened? What do we have to do? Where do we go from here? How do we handle it? What is the meaning of secular Zionism? What is the meaning of religiousism? What is the meaning of anti-Zionism? Agudat Yisrael. Yes, you're absolutely right. A lot of people have told me I'm needed at this crucial, critical moment. Ulam, and here the Rav quotes a medrash, I'll give it to you exactly. Ulam, rabot machsh, ulam, excuse me, rabotenu siprulanu al kipa shel cheshmenot shaita chutz l'Yerushalayim, mitnei shakol hamachshei b'motzei cheshmeno chasen mitztayer, u'b'Yerushalayim katuv misos. Kol Haaretz. What a quote. And of course, what is the Rebbe referring to? The Rebbe is referring to, it's three times in the Medrash. I'll quote it from the Medrash Rabbah to Shmot, Pashat Pekudei, Pashun Bet, right at the end, Omer Reb Yochanan, right at the end of the Medrash Rabbah to Shmot, Omer Reb Yochanan, the Rav knew the Medrash Rabbah inside out. It's twice in the Medrash Rabbah, it's once in the Psikta, but the Psikta the Rav Kahana, I found all the different sources, but Psikta the Rabbah, I should say. But the Rav knew the Medrash Rabbah inside out. And he said, Kipa Shel Cheshbonot. Outside Yerushalayim, Rabbi Yochanan said, there was a big rock, meeting place, where you went and made your cheshbonot, you went and analyzed your bank statement. Why? Why couldn't you analyze your bank statement in Jerusalem? Why couldn't you check your Visa, your MasterCard, your statement? Why did you have to go outside of Yerushalayim? Why did you have to go to the Kippah Shel Cheshbonot? For chol mi shemavakesh lachshov, halach l'sham. Whoever had to make his monthly cheshbon, whoever had to check his canceled checks, went to this kipash cheshbonot. Lama. Why couldn't he do it in Jerusalem? What's the prohibition here? We're talking on a Monday, on a Thursday, on an ordinary weekday. We're not talking chas v'chalila, Shabbos Yontav. What's the prohibition? And the Medrash says, Shalo yachshav b'Yerushalayim v'yatzer, l'fishin ikreit mesos kol haaretz. Because many times, you know, we make the cheshbon, the stocks went under, the dollar dropped in value, the shekel dropped in value, the euro dropped in value, whatever currency you have. You take a look, you charged more than you were supposed to, you can barely cover your charge account. You feel, oh, the bank made a mistake, a little straightened out, you made a mistake. the canceled check. It didn't come in. It did come in. And, it's Agmat Nefesh. Agmat Nefesh, you're not allowed to experience in Jerusalem. Jerusalem, how did the psalmist refer to it? Mesos Kol Haaretz, the most beautiful part of the land, the joy of the land. We sing of the land. We rejoice in the land. This is Yerushalayim. And in Yerushalayim, even to add up 2 and 2 and 4 and 4, and even to look at a bank statement is strictly forbidden, because you may feel upset, you may feel despair, you may feel heartache, you may feel sorrow, you may feel distress, and therefore you have to go chutz l'Yerushalayim. And the Rav says, isn't this magnificent? The Rav says, v'davorim kal v'chomer l'kipah shel avelut korot shaninim sabatocho. And he says, the Rav says, it's a kal v'chomer, it's a fortiori, alachat kama v'kama, this is only cheshbonot. And the Rav says, I'm in a black mood, I'm in a nun mood, I'm in a terrible feeling of depression, of despair, of mourning for my wife. Alachat kama v'kama, eich epshali achshav la'alot Yerushalayima, how can I go up to the holy city of Jerusalem? V'ani ish kishay ruach u'ma nefesh, ein ha'hashra'a chalab matzab shadika'on atzvut v'tzah. The shechina, the joy of life, the happiness of life, the divine inspiration cannot take place when a person is depressed, when a person is sad, when a person feels anguish and pain. And that is my feeling now. How can I go at this moment in time? If one cannot make cheshbonot in Yerushalayim, for fear he will fear despair and feel this feeling of being overwhelmed by a goral, by a fate that is beyond his control. Certainly, if cheshbonot you can't make, in my mourning, in my crying, in my longing for my recently departed wonderful wife, the joy of my life, the apple of my eye, alachat kama v'kama, I cannot go to Jerusalem now. I don't think any commentary is necessary. But the next paragraph is even more important. Because everything the Rebbe said until now, it's overwhelmed. You could say the moment, the tragedy, fine. But nevertheless, there were years before. Why not then? The last paragraph is an absolute validation, certification of what I stated 20 minutes ago. Evidently, Miriam wrote, and you see it from the Rav's answer, she apologized. I mean, how do you come, for the sake of argument, a high school machanechet in Givat, Washington, named Miriam Shiloh, married to a young Talmud Chacham from a different world altogether, the religious Zionist world of Israel? How do you have the nerve, the chutzpah, to write, to rebuke, to reprimand the Gadol Hadar? To reprimand Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, the Einikul, the Neched, the grandson of Rav Chaim, the man who himself is a Gaon Adir, a man who by 1967 had ordained hundreds upon hundreds of Rabbanim, among them Talmudei Chachamim, Muflakim, Rashi Yeshiva, Gedolei Yisrael of the new generation? How does this woman have the chutzpah? And evidently she wrote to the Rav, Rabbi Soloveitchik, you are the Gadol Hadar, you are the great Rosh Yeshiva from Yeshiva Tzitzik Elchanan. I'm only a machanechet of a high school program in Givat, Washington, but nevertheless I apologize, but I feel I must express my feelings and those of my students. Now what the Rav writes back in this paragraph is classic. Aim to be a teacher, Rikal Hitzadek Aldavareha. You don't have to apologize. Gamani Yehudi Pashut. I too am a simple Jew. And if I can paraphrase the rabbis of Yavne, and the Rebbe is paraphrasing the Gemara in Brachot, Hayiti Omer, it's Brachot Yud Zayin, Hayiti Omer would say, Ani Malamed, V'Habei Hamalim HaMetzibur B'Stei HaChinuch HaTorani. The Rav now is stating something. He says, let me translate it. I have found my niche. Have a role in life. Have a goal in life. Have a purpose in life. I have a destiny in life. I teach Torah. And there are many that teach Torah. Ani malachti be'ir New York ha'gedolah. Listen to every syllable here. I am teaching in the great city of New York, the great metropolis of New York. B'mosad Rav Talmidim, Yeshiva University, at that time the largest Torah center in the world. I don't know today. Could be, if you count number of students, maybe Lakewood has more, maybe Ponovich has more. I don't know. But certainly at that time, there were already thousands of students learning Torah daily under the aegis of Yeshiva University. I'm in New York. But there were also people teaching Torah in Gimat, Washington, or in a different city in Israel, in a Mosad Mitzumtzam Bekamuto, an institution that has many less students. However, Echar Hamabe B'Yechat Hamamid U'Buvad She'echav in Libo L'Shamayim. Again, it's a quote from the Gemara at the start of Brachot. Echat Hamabe B'Yechat Hamamid. Whether you do a lot or a little, the most important thing in life is that the Kavana has to be L'Shem Shamayim. Melechet Kulano, all our work, your work, my work, Mukdeshes L'Tipuch Erkei Hayadut, to developing Torah values, Jewish values, Mesorat Avot, the tradition of our fathers, Torah Rabbeinu, the Torah of our forebears, Balei HaKabbalah V'Chachamecha, those who passed on the traditions and the sages. And what is the Rebbe saying in this paragraph? You don't have to apologize, and I don't have to apologize. And in reality, we are engaged in the most important task of all, teaching Torah, inculcating the values that have sustained us to the next generation. We are involved in passing on the tradition, dor l'dor, yishabach ma'asecha. And what we are doing, it doesn't matter whether we're doing it in New York or whether we're doing it in Gibbat, Washington, or whether we're doing it in any other place where Jews find themselves, but we are involved in the most sacred calling and task of all. And in this paragraph, you see the great Sion of the Briska family. You see the Rav. You see the Rosh Yeshiva. You see the man who found himself. You see the individual who wandered through so many countries, so many cultures. No other gadol was exposed, as we've seen in his life, from Kluzhana to Resen, to Haslovich, to Warsaw, to Berlin, to Boston, with all that implies. And he yet remained loyal with all the additional garments he wore. The basic garment was that of his father, Reb Moshe, that of his grandfather, Reb Chaim, that of his great-grandfather, Reb Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, his other great-grandfather, Reb Rafol Shapir, Reb Rafol Volozhin, who was the son-in-law of the great Netziva Volozhin. And you see that this ultimately became the Rav's calling life. This ultimately became his own personal destiny in life. This became the heart of his shlichut in life. And this is the niche he found. You see the understanding in 1967 when he looks back on his life. He sees the divine providence. He sees the Goral and the Yud intermingling, at times debating with each other, at times complimenting each other, supplementing each other. But ultimately, when one has the calling to teach Torah, the Rav has discharged his shlichut in New York, in Boston, and Miriam Shiloh is in Givat, Washington, and Kedumim afterwards. So, what a magnificent letter. What a magnificent response. What a level of writing Hebrew. What an integration of Maimorei Chazal in beautiful, basic, modern Hebrew, which every Israeli can comprehend and understand. But look how the great Gadol Hador, Gadol Mirabin Shemo, Rabbi Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, was moved by the letter from the Machanechet Miriam Shiloh of Givat Washington, why didn't you come in Aliyah? And look how he took out the time to respond. Look how he took out the time to answer. Look how he explained himself, not to justify, admitted he was a sinner, admitted he was lacking, admitted he didn't meet the call, didn't rise to the challenge, but nevertheless explained himself that it's a time of tragedy in life. Halavai, had his wife lived longer, everything would have been different. He's overwhelmed by mourning. How can one go to the holy city of Jerusalem in the mood of despair instead of the mood of joy? And the last paragraph, so revealing, the Rav found his niche. And in retrospect, the answer I proposed in Stele Yohu more than 30 years ago was right on. In 1935, he was knocking on the door. You didn't open it. When you opened the door, he already was not around to enter because he had found other doors of fulfillment and of becoming the Rabban Shel Yisrael. But let me go one step further. It's a very moving letter to me, overwhelming. And it shows the love of his wife, a lesson that we all need in modern times when marriage is treated so tritely and there's so much divorce among Orthodox Jews. What goes on in the non-Jewish world, the non-Torah world, ultimately comes to our world. It should not be. The strength of Torah should be great enough and big enough to enable us to rise above the trends and the currents, the pulls and the influences. And yet, take a look at the Rav's dedication and love for his wife. There's so much in this letter. I hold that just as people study the Kol Dodido fake, this letter should be appendix to it, and every young person growing up should study this letter and analyze it and feel who the Rav was and what his life was made out of. However, I have to state that now you'll understand why we're sitting where we're sitting in this very study hall in the heart and center of the holy city of Jerusalem. What I imagine, and I can't prove this because Mr. Griss is no longer with us, but I'm absolutely certain it may be a theory, but I'm certain it's 99% correct. Mr. Griss was very close to the Rav, very close to the Rebbetzin, extremely close to the Rebbetzin. And Mr. Griss was, of course, party to all this that was happening. He, by the mid-60s, had become a big investor in the state of Israel. And slowly but surely, Mr. Griss was becoming more convinced that the future of the Torah people was aligned with the developments in the Holy Land. Mr. Griss was very active in helping to build the Israeli Museum. But as he came to know the Rav and the Rebbetzin better, he felt that the Rav had to teach in Israel. And he evidently knew about this plan that they were developing or evolving, that the Rebbetzin, and I know this from the family as well, the Rebbetzin was extremely looking forward, extremely involved, dreaming that she could spend part of the time in Eretz Israel. It would be the ultimate fulfillment of a life that began in Vilna, took her to Berlin, with the Rav, took her to Boston, and the Rebbetzin was a tremendous Zionist, and the rebirth of Israel, the strengthening of Israel. And you have to understand this period as well. Until the Sinai campaign, people were not positive the state would survive. The state was young, the state was poor, the state was overwhelmed by immigration from the Arabic countries of the Jews running away. We spoke about that an hour ago, and how powerful was the army?
And of course, when the Rav delivered this talk in 1956, it was on the eve, basically, of the Sinai campaign that happens later that year, in October of 56. And the Sinai campaign, little Israel wins this tremendous victory against the powerful Egyptian army and goes all the way to the canal. Of course, due to Eisenhower later, we have to give it up, Eisenhower and Dulles. Now it's a tragedy which results later in the Six-Day War and the loss of many more Jewish lives. But little Israel, by 50, when the Sinai campaign is over, little Israel's on the map. They're not going to be wiped out anymore. They're going to have problems, they're going to have difficulties, they're going to have terrorist attacks. They have the Fadayan then, they were called, what, the forerunner of what we call the PLO today, and Hamas and Hezbollah, but they're not going to be wiped out. And it's a reality, and we have to live with it, and it's real. And little by little, it's developing more, and people are going back and forth. And you know, you have yeshiva, boys are going to study in Kiryat Biafna, boys are going to study in Itri afterwards, and people are going back and forth. And the Rebbetzin, she's a real Zionist. This is, you know, from youth. And we have to go. And the Rebbe would have went, and Mr. Gris was part of it. And that's why Mr. Gris then starts pressuring the Rebbe, and he tells him, and I know this from Mr. Gris word by word, he says, "You are the greatest teacher of Torah in our generation. And Israel today is the greatest achievement of the Jewish people. You, the greatest teacher of Torah, must at least teach part of the year in the state of Israel, our greatest achievement. You must come home for part of the year." And Mr. Gris started to press the Rav. And this was a difficult period for the Rav. See, when his wife was alive, she essentially made the decisions. The Rav was involved, but you lean on your wife. An intelligent man knows, the Gemara says, "Need the bina yitei rabin Hashem." The women have insight. The women know which way to go. The women know what to do. Now, the Rebbetzin wasn't there. The Rebbe found his solace in teaching Torah. The Rebbe said this more than once. I quote Rebbe now. He said this at a Shuvah Drash. He said, "I would have lost my mind if not for the fact that I was able to go on teaching Torah." And I have to pay tribute. You have to understand, the community of Boston deserves special tribute. Because after the Rebbetzin died, during the school year, the Rebbe went to New York. So he had a schedule. He was busy. He had what to do. Came the summer, and in the past summers, he would have gone to a summer home on Hyannisport with the Rebbetzin. Now, that was no more. And the community of Boston undertook, I believe it was from 1968 on, that they brought boys from New York who wanted to come and study with the Rebbe, and made available room and board to study with the Rav on the lawn of Maimonides. Summer after summer, this continued. So that the Rav basically was surrounded by Habatzat HaTorah, not just during the academic year of Yeshiva University, but the summer months as well in Boston. And some of the top Talmidim came up to Boston. This was many names today, famous people. They studied with the Rav in Boston. They had the extra time, that extra amount, the extra nearness. And of course, being with him in Boston was a lot different than being with him in New York in a big classroom. Menachem Ganak is an example. The Holzer brothers of that era were close to the Rav. You talk about those that later become Rashi Yeshiva in YU. And Boston was a tremendous experience during the summer. And the Boston community did that for the Rav. So you see, the Rav now was totally enveloped in teaching Torah. He had no Rebbetzin to question, to ask, to make the decisions, to think, to carry the burden. Mr. Gris leaned on the Rav. And the Rav finally, in a moment of weakness, you understand, Mr. Gris, after all, was an influence on the Rav's life, just as the Rav influenced Mr. Gris. But Mr. Gris, with his ability to give at that moment tens of millions of dollars already to charity, to Jewish education, to chinuch, this was extremely important. So you could not say no with a capital N to Mr. Gris. And finally the Rav said, "Yes, all right." And Mr. Gris said, "Rebbe, I'm going to build you a building. You're going to have a beautiful apartment. You're going to have a beautiful classroom in which to teach. I'm going to build everything." And the Rav probably looks at Mr. Griff quixotically, you understand. He's building a campus. He's building a home. He's gonna build him a place to teach Torah. He probably looked at him quixotically. And he said, all right, you know, figuring when you do it, I'll be ready. You'll do it. Mashiach will be here before. You know that attitude. You know that approach. And Mr. Griff started building the campus. It took a number of years. And this is the Griff campus. 20 dunam in a prime location in the holy city, built originally for the Rav. Unfortunately, by the time the campus was ready, the mourning for his wife, it was the mid-70s, the reconstruction of his life, which only reconstructed around teaching Torah, Lima Torah, Habatzat Torah, spreading Torah, not beyond that, his own poor health, which continued to degenerate in the 70s into the 80s. As you know, the Rav was unable to come to teach Torah in Jerusalem. And nevertheless, this building, this campus, where we sit, where we study, where these lectures are delivered, are a direct testimony to the Rav, to the Rebbetzin, to that original plan that they started to evolve in the mid-60s when they were growing older and said, it's time to move on, time to experience Israel, time to come home to a certain degree, time to see in a tangible feeling, a tangible hold, the creation of what we dreamt about. Look what we've seen during our lifetimes, from pogroms to World War I, to the interbellum period, to World War II, to the Holocaust, to the creation of the state, to the miracles. It's time to answer the knocks on our doors. It's time to open the doors. It's time to make the move, at least partially. The Rav writes, 6 months a year. I heard this from family members. I quote, if mother had lived longer, if the Rebbetzin had lived longer, they would have begun to spend half a year in Israel. And Nebuch, the Rebbetzin, didn't survive her illness. She passed away, but Mr. Griss already caught on, heard this type of thought, heard this type of thinking, and Mr. Griss started pressuring the Rav and started dreaming and started committing millions of dollars and built this beautiful, magnificent campus. And the plan was exactly as the Rebbe expressed it in this letter. I knew this long before this letter appeared. But I see in the letter, it totally justified every drop of knowledge I had acquired from the family and rumors and stories about this period. And hearing Mr. Grissom, having lived it with Mr. Grissom in the early 70s. And 6 months a year. That was Mr. Griss's original plan. 6 months in New York, 6 months in Jerusalem, and Mr. Joseph Griss provides for all the Rav's material temporal needs and gives him a classroom, a building, a Beis Medrash to teach, to make the voice of Torah heard. But of course, at that moment of life when the building is ready, as Rav Michal Katz said to me, when this all end, Rav Michal Katz said to me back in the 60s, I already was a Rosh Yeshiva in YU, and Rav Michal, my first Rebbe, you know, used to talk quite often, quite frequently, and he was telling me all that his father is doing to make it unanimous, the Rav's election. And finally, when the Rav rejected it, So Rav Michal said to me a few years later, he expressed it, because he always recounted the story. It was like a very important moment in his life. He was the shliach between his great father, the Degel Reuven, and the Rav, Rabban Shel Yisrael. And Rav Michal Katz was the shliach, the intermediary between them, talking with his father, speaking with his father, getting letters from his father, talking with the Rav, talking to his father, getting a letter from the Rav, passing it back and forth, coordinating it. And Rav Michal Katz said, Hu lo zacha v'hein lo zachu. We all lost out. The Rav was in privilege to become the chief rabbi of Israel, and Israel was in privilege to have the Rav as the chief rabbi. With the Griss Center, I'll put it a little bit more mildly. Hu lo zacha v'hein kein zachu. The Rav was in privilege to teach here, but the state of Israel was privileged to have a campus where the heart of its dedication is to perpetuating the Torah, the teaching, the hashkafa, the gestalt, the Weltanschauung of Moreinu v'Rabbeinu, HaRab Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. So if I can reiterate, today's lecture was extremely moving for me because that letter from Miriam Shiloh pulls at the heart of every Jew to whom Torah and Zion are meaningful. And I had the privilege that, for whatever the reasons were, when they decided to make the letter public, I was one of the first to receive a copy from the family. I actually gave the letter to the Lichtensteins and others, and it's an overwhelming letter. Just to see the Rav's handwriting and the time at which he wrote it and how he wrote it, it's just Rebbe at his ultimate ability of insight, self-analysis, Chazal, beautiful modern Hebrew, and the great Rav writing to a Nishab Shutara, she calls herself, whom he never met, and how the Rav can write Gamani Yish Pashut. And that's really the way the Rav viewed himself. If you understood the Rav, if you understand any great Torah Jew, we're nobody, we're nothing. All that we are is that we saw the earlier generation. That's Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's father. Rishonim Malachim, Manu B'nei Anoshim, Rishonim B'nei Anoshim, Manu Chamorim. Rabbi Yisrael asked, why do we have the right to teach if we're nobody? And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said, but in our youth we saw great people. And that's what Torah is all about. If someone's arrogant, if someone's a Baal Gaiva, it's a sign he hasn't inherited Torah properly. If someone is humble and he understands how little he knows compared to his Rebbeim, Gedoli Yisrael, compared to the earlier generations, that's a Ben Torah. And that's why he'll never grow haughty. As much as he knows, as much as he's influenced, he'll always remain Ish Pashut, the way the Rav characterized himself to the Isha Pshuta, to Miriam Shiloh. So what did we do today? In the fifth of the six lectures, we finished out the Kol Dodi Del Fake. It's an amazing document. I repeat again, arguably, I use the word arguably, that may have been the Rav's greatest moment in life. Ein l'don lam shen lo sha'ah, millions and millions of people, who knows, it'll hit tens of millions, will be raised on this essay of the Rav. No one captured the moment as Rebbe did that evening in Nathan Lamport Auditorium at Yeshiva University, on the 8th anniversary of the State of Israel. Dam Yehudei no Hefka, you take it for granted today. You know what this means after the Holocaust, what they did to us, what they did to us after the Holocaust, they did to us in Poland, what they did to the returnees, how they butchered Jews who survived Hitler. They butchered them in cold blood. See, read Eisenstein and see how Yaf Elyach's mother is butchered after the return, let alone those of a family who were killed during the Holocaust. And here with all our difficulty, but Dam Yehudei no Hefka. And of course, the gates are open. Every Jew in the world can come in Aliyah like a mother filled with pity and love for her children. The State of Israel welcomes us with open arms. Ein Rachmaniyah, in the Rav's words. And of course, if this is the case, then the question has to be asked, Rebbe, why didn't you come in Aliyah? And this question was asked so many times, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein refers to it in his essay. I was asked the question already many decades ago, and the answer is multifaceted, but that's part of life. The question's unfair. There's Goral Yehud, and Aaron Rakepet said it very nicely. When the Rav knocked on the door, they didn't open it. When the door was open, the Rav was already in other doors. He had walked in. He had other homes. He had a niche. And with all the mourning and all that, he writes to Miriam Shiloh. But the most fascinating part is the last part, wherein the Rav describes, I teach Torah and you teach Torah. And as far as teaching Torah, it really doesn't matter whether we're in Boston or in Jerusalem or in Givat Washington. Our main goal is to raise the new generation. Translated, I have my niche in life today. It's hard for me to leave. But yet, Mr. Grish caught on, 6 months here, 6 months there, and this is the Grist campus in which we sit. My dear friends, next week's lecture, we have to deal with the Rav. Was he really a Mizrachiite? The individual is. The documents I will reveal. And then the Rav's attitude, land for peace, burning issues. We have to see the totality of the Rav's position. And finally, end off with the Rav's own Divrei Torah that are as meaningful today as when they were uttered some unto 40 years ago. Thank you very much.